All right, shit show ladies. Have you ever had those days where everything just feels so much damn harder than normal and you can't figure out why? I already know the answer to that question is yes. And boy, have I definitely had more than my fair share of those days and totally get just how frustrating this can be. But recently, I've learned that sometimes it's not just stress, lack of sleep, a dysregulated nervous system. It could also be my hormones at play. And that is where Happy Mammoth comes in. They offer a free 2-minute quiz that can help you uncover the root cause of your hormonal symptoms. It's super easy. Any shit show can do it. Just answer a few questions about what you've been going through and where you're at in life. After taking this quiz, you'll get personalized recommendations to help balance your hormones and start feeling better. So I took this hormone quiz myself. The quiz suggested that my body may be overloaded with estrogen, which is affecting me in all kinds of ways. And one of the recommendations that I got was to start taking Hormone Harmony, which helps with bloating, chronic fatigue, weight gain, mood swings, and more. And after adding it to my routine, I've definitely noticed a difference. Now, taking care of your hormones isn't just about feeling good right now. It's also about investing in our healing journey. And so by taking this quiz, you'll learn more about your hormone balance, which will allow you to start making small, intentional changes to support you on this healing journey. Whether it's the Hormone Harmony or another Happy Mammoth product, the quiz helps guide you towards solutions that work specifically for you. So if you're ready to start feeling like yourself again, head over to happymammoth.com and take their free 2-minute hormone quiz today to find out the ultimate answer to your stubborn hormonal issues. And for a limited time, you can also get 15% off your entire first order with my code adultchild at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code adultchild for 15% off today.
Ever feel like your WordPress site is moving in slow motion? Switch to Kinsta's managed hosting for WordPress and watch it fly. Host your site on Google Cloud's fastest servers with worldwide data centers so your pages load instantly. Need help? WordPress experts respond in under 2 minutes and will migrate to your site for free. Try it yourself. First month free at Kinsta.com. That's Kinsta.com. Kinsta, simply better hosting.
You are not required to set yourself on fire to keep other people warm. My name is Andrea, and this is Adult Child.
What you holding on to? Just let it all go. What's making you slow now? Just let it all go.
Welcome back to Adult Child, where we take a deep dive into the impact of growing up in a dysfunctional family. Ahoy, my dear shit shows. For any new listeners, my name is Andrea. I am a total and complete shit show. I am an adult child of an alcoholic and dysfunctional family. And I realized this after dating two alcoholics, two emotionally unavailable alcoholics named Brian. And that realization was the biggest blessing that I've ever received. Because for years, I was in therapy trying to figure out what the hell was wrong with me and wasn't getting anywhere. And it was through this realization that I was an adult child, that I had complex trauma, that I was actually able to start healing. And so this is the podcast where we talk about what the hell to do when you realize that your childhood fucked you up a whole hell of a lot more than you initially thought it did. Yes, we curse here. You've been warned. I'm an acquired taste. You've been warned. So today we are circling back to Adult Child episode number 56, all the way back in April of 2022. So this is with Dr. Sarah Michaud, someone who had years of sobriety, a successful therapy practice, and thought that she was doing just fine until she found herself in a toxic relationship that finally forced her to confront the deep unhealed trauma that she didn't even know was still running the show, right? The story for so many of us. In this episode, we are taking a deep dive into what codependency really is, how trauma keeps us performing instead of connecting, and why we often have no damn clue what it is that we actually need, let alone know how to ask for it. We are also talking about why healing isn't about doing it right, but about learning how to sit in the discomfort. I just also want to note that she is the author of Co-Crazy, One Psychologist Recovery from Codependency and Addiction, Highly recommend. I'll put a link to this in the show notes. So let's get on with the damn show. How about we? But first, let's talk about what you need to damn the Doyen Shit Show, my online support community where we have a minimum of 6 groups a week, 3 regular shit show support group. We have a book club that meets on Monday. We have a CSA survivors group that meets every Wednesday. We have a divorce and separation group. Every other week, we have an IFS healing group with trauma coach Jesse, and the employment struggle chest group. Say that for employment struggle chest. Employment struggle chest. And that is where you can talk about anything and everything employment or non-employment related. This is also a support community at your fingertips in your back pocket where we have a 24/7 chat where you can connect with other fellow shit shows who are doing the damn work to heal. This is relational trauma, folks. We heal relational trauma through safe relationships. So you, the person that's been wanting to join for forever. I just want to note, we just had somebody join the damn shit show who'd only been listening to the podcast for 3 days. Shout out, Jackie. So you, the person that's been wanting to join for years, how about we do it already, okay? How about we do it? See the link in the show notes, or you can head to adultchildpodcast.com/shitshow. There you can also see a schedule of all the groups that we have. Let's just do it, folks. Okay, let's just do it. Next, give me a little follow on the Insta, on the TikTok, at adultchildpod. Hey, also too, I have a newsletter. You can also find a link to that in the show notes. I've been sending out some top-notch content every week, diving deep into various topics. Last week I did, is it fawning or is it people-pleasing? Yesterday I sent out an article about how so many of us don't realize that we have childhood trauma because we're viewing our childhood through our adult mind. So putting out some good content there. See, again, you can see the link to subscribe to that in the show notes. And last but not least, whatever you do, please give me a damn 5-star rating on Apple and Spotify. Thank you. Love you all.
What is dedication?
The thing that drives me every day as a dad is Dariana. We call him Day-Day for short. Every day he's hungry for something, whether it's attention, affection, knowledge. And there's this huge responsibility in making sure that when he's no longer under my wing, that he's a good person. I want him to be able to sit back one day and go, we worked together, we did a good job.
That's dedication. Find out more at fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.
Coverage varies by plan. View contracts and exclusions at endurancewarranty.com.
If you're driving a car or truck with an expired warranty and suddenly lost your transmission or needed a full engine repair, would a $4,000 repair bill leave you stranded? I'm Danica Patrick. Don't get caught off guard with a vehicle breakdown. Choose the company I trust, Endurance. No matter the mileage, if your vehicle is less than 20 years old, Endurance offers comprehensive auto protection plans for any budget. Protection on the drivetrain, electrical, transmission, AC, and more. Plus, benefits like 24/7 roadside assistance and rental car reimbursement on any plan. Endurance handles everything from making the claim through the repair process to paying the certified mechanic of your choice. Don't get caught off guard with a vehicle breakdown. Act now and get 1 full year of elite benefits, a $2,000 value, free.
Visit endurancewarranty.com for your fast free quote today. That's endurancewarranty.com.
Coverage varies by plan. View contracts and exclusions at endurancewarranty.com.
If you're driving a car or truck with an expired warranty and suddenly lost your transmission or needed a full engine repair, would a $4,000 repair bill leave you stranded? I'm Danica Patrick. Don't get caught off guard with a vehicle breakdown. Choose the company I trust, Endurance. No matter the mileage, if your vehicle is less than 20 years old, Endurance offers comprehensive auto protection plans for any budget. Protection on the drivetrain, electrical, transmission, AC, and more. Plus, benefits like 24/7 roadside assistance and rental car reimbursement on any plan. Endurance handles everything from making the claim through the repair process to paying the certified mechanic of your choice. Don't get caught off guard with a vehicle breakdown. Act now and get 1 full year of elite benefits, a $2,000 value, free.
Visit endurancewarranty.com for your fast free quote today. That's endurancewarranty.com.
Okay, everybody, it is my pleasure to introduce a recovering shit show. Psychologist, codependent, recovering addict, Sarah Michaud. Hello.
Hi there.
Hi. She's the author of the new book, Co-Crazy, One Psychologist Recovery from Codependency and Addiction. So glad to have somebody that suffers from codependency and addiction, because I've always just been so curious what that's like.
Probably most of the listeners know what it's like, I would think.
They don't either. None of them.
The reason I put codependency first too is a lot of people write books on addiction, and there are like these stories of them kind of getting sober, and then that's the end of the story. And I really believe people are codependent way before they get addicted, right? I mean,
absolutely.
We grow up usually in some type of dysfunction leading to our codependency. So I think a lot of addictions are covering up the codependency, or whatever you want to call it, the way we relate to people, the way we relate to others, and really relate to ourselves. Mm-hmm. You know, that's how I see codependency. It's like, I can't tolerate whatever's happening within me, and I can't tolerate whatever's happening within someone else.
Absolutely.
And, you know, so.
I mean, I guess I see it kind of as, it's kind of the same thing, but it's like the disease of family dysfunction. I think what right. I realized for me was like, I always knew that alcohol was a symptom.
Yes.
But I don't think that I realized that my alcoholism was a symptom.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, it's a they say mental, physical, spiritual, but to me, the most powerful part is the mental illness, because I mean, it's an illness that people die from because their minds tell them they don't have it. I mean, denial being the quintessential component, right? And the thing is, you can get sober. And I remember my first sponsor saying, yeah, we can get sober, but we can still rationalize, minimize, romanticize, deny pretty much everything else. So the mental illness is still alive and well, even though we put down the drugs and alcohol. So
I think for me, it was like getting sober allowed for that shit to just manifest and grow and fester, you know?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And especially if you're going to try to get into relationships, which of course, you know, I was having sex in treatment. So I mean, most of us, right, in the laundry room. I mean, so relationships were my go-to. I mean, you know, I put down booze and I picked up boys pretty quickly and kept crashing and burning and didn't even realize that that was part of my inability to be with myself. And that, like, you talk a lot about the trauma and the abandonment and all the reasons why I was doing that behavior, but really because I couldn't be with myself. Yeah.
And I think it's even more painful. Like, I think that being an active codependency, like as a sober person, that is like way more fucking painful than being an active alcoholism or addiction, in my opinion.
Right. Right. Like
the most miserable thing in the whole world.
Well, it's those, you know, like they talk about in the big book, those underlying causes and conditions, right? It's the fear, it's the anger, it's the shame, it's the, you know, the anxiety, the panic, the all of it, feeling less than. And, you know, like I said, when I was in the book, I talk about going to treatment when I was 10 years sober and I was in a graduate program in San Diego. And I just was bottoming out with relationships. And I'll never forget, you know, on the board where it said, you know, addicts, 95% problems, 5% addiction, and co-addicts, 100% problems. So this delusion that the addict is the one that's fucked up and the co-addict, you know, is kind of fine, is just so bizarre to me.
They're more fucked up.
Yes. Both equally fucked up. And one of the reasons I really wrote the book is because of my own countertransference, you know, when people are therapists, when our own issues come up, it's called countertransference. Mm-hmm. And very often the codependents were way more frustrating for me than the addicts. The addicts, at least, you know, if they were in denial, I could joke with them. They could acknowledge it. They may not be ready, or they were just really ready to get clean and sober. But the co-addicts, if a couple came in, very often they wanted to just say, if he or she gets sober, we'll be fine. Mm-hmm. And I would try to say, well, it really, both of you have issues. They're just different issues. But the partner's denial and lack of willingness to look at that they were part of the problem was shocking to me. So, yeah, I'm rambling, but go ahead.
No, ramble away. Yeah. Yeah, that's so interesting. Because I've noticed that that was definitely very present in my parents' relationship.
Got it.
And I think that, and I'm curious, I mean, there's so many different things going on, but obviously part of it is like the person, the codependent not wanting to have to look at their own shit. But I also think too that there's a part of it where the codependent, not on a conscious level, but on a subconscious level, wants the person to stay sick. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think the codependent is terrified. You know, the addict's terrified of getting sober, and the codependent person is terrified of what's going to happen if they get sober, or what's going to happen if this isn't the focus. I mean, my dad was the codependent. My mom was the alcoholic. And he always wanted to present, maybe like your parents says, he was the good guy. You know, if mom would just get sober, and she went to a bunch of treatments, Betty Ford and all these things, but she would come home and then, oh, mom can have a glass of wine. Mm. Do you know what I mean? And it's like, no, she can't. She can't. Mm-hmm. And their denial is so amazing. That's another reason I wrote the book, because, and I say it in the book, we want to be the good guys. You know, the codependents always want to be the ones that are nice, and I've taken care of them, and I've self-sacrificed. When really, no, you're in it because you're just as afraid and angry and shameful, and but there's this, they're the good guys and we're the bad guys kind of presentation. And I wanted to break that up, that they're getting something out of it, like you said.
Exactly. There's a payoff for sure.
Yes. Right.
And part of it is, and what it talks about, like in the Big Red Book and stuff, is just the, yes, like the addiction to excitement and just like the, yeah.
Yes. Or being a victim.
Yes. Being a victim.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think that that's what's so crazy about all this is like, at least when you're like an addict or an alcoholic, there is some sort of like a euphoria, but like on the other end of it, I mean, it's like really just like, oh, I'm just like, you're just like seeking out shitty feelings. Like that's fucking nuts.
Well, also it's the control, that attachment and addiction to control and thinking they're managing their lives when really they're falling apart. But this idea that I can control this other person or live in the delusion that I can control the other person, that's how they feel safe or whatever, or don't feel their own feelings. I'll just focus on you. Yeah, yeah. Control is a huge part, huge. And of course, underneath it being just crippled by fear. I mean, I just think, and I know I simplify things a lot, but fear for me is so much at the bottom line of everything. You know, we're only born with two fears, right? The fear of, I think, loud noises and falling.
Oh, really?
And yeah. And so when I do four steps with people, I mean, people have up to 300 fears. And those are the things, if you think about it, it's not just the fear. It's all about our adaptations and behaviors that we've accumulated over the years to deal with the fear. Whether it's a fear of abandonment or a fear of not being liked or not being loved or rejection or whatever, control, fear of being controlled, you know, fear of not being good enough. And those all started somewhere, at least in my belief system.
I agree.
I don't believe they just randomly occur.
No,
right?
Of course not. They're, no.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's interesting. The fear of falling. That's weird. Like that,
yeah.
That a baby would have.
Right. Almost like a real genetic is not the right word I'm looking for, but primal. Yeah. The fear of falling in love, no, like safety. It's like a safety thing, I would think. Yeah.
Huh. What about with, and then we can talk about your story, but with your experience of working with couples, how often are you seeing that when, the one partner gets sober,
does the deal, and then the other partner doesn't do anything, and then even if the codependent does seek recovery, it's like we both change, and then we realize that we're like actually not a good fit.
Right. I mean, I hate to say it, and I don't know statistically, but I think it's pretty common for a couple to come in and the guy or woman's been drinking for 25 years and they don't know each other. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, pretty much the one person has been coping with a substance and the other person has just been enraged. So, I mean, that happens a lot. A theme I see a lot is when someone gets sober and they're going to their meetings and they're doing therapy, and the other person might go to an Al-Anon meeting once or read a book, but they're still preoccupied and crippled by their rage. Mm. And I hear that a lot. So the couple will come in and they'll say, well, you got sober, but now you're out all the time or whatever. And it's hard for them to see that the anger has been there forever, that their anger isn't just about their husband, that they were probably angry way before they even met their husband. And their husband or wife is a good reason to be angry. But I always say that the only way people can really work through stuff is if both people, and you know this, own their part and say, I am responsible for my part. Mm. Because very often you're exactly right. Someone will get sober, and it does not mean the marriage magically or the relationship magically gets better. Absolutely not. In fact, it will most likely get worse for a while.
Yeah. That's what I said in my last episode. And I've been having conversations with friends about it. It's not just romantically, but just in relationships in general. I don't have room in my life for people who are not going to be able to like own their shit, you know?
Yes. Yes. And I always use the word, like, if someone's willing, that's really the word. Because again, someone may not even be aware that they have certain dynamics in a relationship. But if you're willing to listen and say, oh, geez, I didn't know that, and not get all defensive or attached to it. I mean, we all have stuff. I always say relationships are like the petri dish of dysfunction, because, you know, when we get into a relationship, those first 3 months are usually when all of our oldest, deepest fears get activated. It's just the nature of relationship. Mm-hmm. And so if we don't have a language to talk about that stuff, I mean, think about the highs and lows you experience in those first 3 months. It's like you're psychotic. I mean, a famous psychologist, Irving Yalom, used to say falling in love is like, it's like delusional, because you don't even know this person. And then within a week, you're ready to marry them. I mean, very often. And it's just this whole delusional activation.
You mean like 2 days, you mean? After the first phone conversation?
Right. You've got the wedding plan. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Right.
Practicing the last in cursive.
Right. It's hard to get into reality and to see the facts when all those old feelings get activated. And that feeling of love is very seductive, or attraction. Just attraction. I mean, which obviously has nothing to do with really the person that's right for us, but absolutely, it sure can get us going. You know this, right?
Yeah. Yeah. But I mean, I can't even get them to go to the 3 month mark. So,
yeah. Well, is that good or bad?
I think it's
not the right person, or?
It's, yeah, I just, I'm imploding that shit real fast. I'm on the speed track. I'm on the speed track. The second part two of the book is your journey.
It's my little journey. Yeah. My so bottoms.
Let's break this down into childhood, active addiction, and then codependency addiction. So tell me about your dysfunctional family.
Okay. All right. I had 4 brothers. I was the only girl. I was right in the middle. Mm-hmm. And as far back as I can remember, there was just always chaos, fighting, and drama. Now, whether those are the facts, I don't know. But, you know, I remember being 2 or 3, you know, huddling next to my door while my parents are screaming and fighting. You know, the typical MO would be my mother would start drinking in the afternoon. My dad would come home from work. They'd start fighting at dinner, and then that would be it. We'd all go into our rooms or do homework. But when I would go to, when we'd go to sleep, usually is when my mother would go upstairs and the fighting and screaming would begin. So there was just a lot of chaos. You know, there were several mornings when I came downstairs and my mother would have a black eye or have bruises on her arm. I think mainly it probably was from falling. Would get into physical altercations, but it wasn't like my father was beating my mother at all, but it was more just the screaming and the yelling, but sure.
And was the next morning as if nothing had ever happened?
Yeah, all those ACOA, like not knowing what normal is. You know, I remember coming up from school one day in high school, and my mother was on the living room floor, and I thought she was dead. And she was just drunk, obviously. But as a kid, you don't know that. And I, you know, so just bizarre, you know, not knowing what normal is, thinking this is how people relate. I mean, I remember going to friends' houses for lunch and thinking, what kind of fantasy land is this? Like, you know, people are screaming and there's no tension, like that chronic tension. I don't know if you felt that, like when people don't get along, you know, we joked about it that my parents had a fight that lasted 42 years. I mean, the kids are in this kind of heightened state all the time, waiting for something to happen, even when something's not happening. Your system is just in a chronic state of activation. So, yeah.
Yes. Was your mother's alcoholism, was that ever discussed? Like, at what age do you think that you became aware that she had a drinking problem?
Oh, so young. I mean, five.
Oh, wow.
I mean, literally elementary school. I mean, yeah, I think kids know way younger than some of my clients like to believe. Like, I think being an alcoholic parent is so freaking painful once you get sober. And I think it's hard for parents to realize that their kids know way younger than they think that. Because a lot of times someone will come in and say, oh, my kids weren't affected. No, it's like, yeah, they were. They were. Even if you hit it, they were. You're not emotionally present. And not that it's not extremely painful to be a parent and get sober and deal with that, but I knew pretty young, and all my brothers knew pretty young.
Wait, yeah. Sorry, I can't remember if you said this already, but where did you fall in the line of the kids?
Right in the middle. I had two older and two younger, and it's bizarre. I'm sure you've had other people say this. It was like two separate families. My two older brothers, even though we're only like 2 years apart, they were very close. And then myself and my two younger brothers were very close. So it was like these two separate units. And
what role did you play?
I was the kind of peacekeeper, you know, in the all the ACOA books, I'm the lost child, the third child. But I think we all had many of the different roles. We were all comedians. I mean, humor was a huge coping skill. My brother started smoking pot probably in eighth grade. So our house became this, like, we had this, you know, attic where all my brother's friends would hang out. And I mean, the house just reeked of pot all the time. Of course, my parents really never addressed it, even though I'm sure they smelled it. So there was all these bizarre things happening that no one was really talking about. I mean, as we got older, I remember begging my father to divorce my mother. Mm-hmm. And he literally said to me, how do I know it's going to be better without her? And I was just like, how could it possibly get any worse? I mean, you guys fight all the time. And that kind of narcissism of the alcoholic and the codependent too, where it's all about them, rather than thinking, oh, it's awful for the kids to grow up this way. I mean, that's the thing too, that's so infuriating. You know, my father infuriated me a lot more than my mother did. My mother had an illness. I always thought he could have done something, you know, but he couldn't, obviously, because of his own dysfunction.
You know? I know. Yeah. No, I can totally relate to that. I think, especially as us as alcoholics, you know, like it's a lot easier for me to identify with my mother's illness.
Right.
So were there conversations though, but either between you and your siblings or directly with your parents, like specifically about your mother's drinking?
Yeah. I mean, my brothers and I would talk about it all the time. I'm sure we talked to our dad a couple of times about it. She did go to several treatment centers. She went to Betty Ford. She went to several places around here.
How old the first time? How old were you when she went to treatment for the first time?
Probably teens.
Okay.
But of course, you know, Betty Ford at that time, whatever year this was, had this program for that was a month, and then a program that was 3 months for the real heavy hitters. And of course, my mother, you know, they recommended to stay for 3 months. And she's like, no, I've got this, and didn't stay. And tragically, I mean, it's really sad. She never got sober, and she died at 67, you know, pretty much from smoking the sun and eating steaks for breakfast back then. But, you know, I mean, my parents' generation didn't have the best lifestyles. Marlboros, martinis, and steak for breakfast and laying in the sun. So, yeah.
What do you know about your parents' upbringings?
My mom's mom was an alcoholic, and one of her brothers was an alcoholic. I'm not sure about the other. So it definitely went back in, you know, the grandparents. My dad's parents, his father was deceased when I was born. So I don't really know about his parents that much and their history. You know, my dad was a WW2 vet, and I think he was undiagnosed with PTSD. I mean, he was an attorney, but he was the rage machine. You know, they didn't even know what it was back then. So, I think that was a lot of his stuff, let alone just the co-crazy that developed by being with my mom, you know. So
where was he deployed to?
He literally liberated concentration camps. You know, he saw everything. And again, back then, because of the GI Bill, he ended up going to Harvard Law School and became this successful lawyer. But I think that's how he coped, right? Just workaholism and emotionally just totally detached. So, you know, he would come home, my mother would cook him dinner, like the 60s, and he would go up to his room, and that was it. We didn't really see much of him. And then he'd try to connect on weekends. So that was,
Did he ever share about his experiences in the war?
I mean, I got much closer to him as I got older and got sober. Yes, we got pretty darn close, and he's written some and left us these little journals about his experience in World War II, but I don't know much about his childhood. I really don't. I mean, sometimes, and this is going to sound crazy, I think he was gay. Mm-hmm. And I think he lived a life of quiet desperation for a variety of reasons. I just believe that. And I think because of his age and his generation, he never could explore that. Mm-hmm. So
fascinating.
I know so many secrets in the family, right? Yeah.
Yeah. You should listen to if you haven't listened to it, I have an episode. I think it's in the first 15 or so, but his name is Alan Kaufman, and his mother was a Holocaust survivor. That's fascinating.
Absolutely.
So growing up, like, were you aware, at what point were you aware that, like when your mother was going into treatment and stuff, was it ever made clear to you that this is a genetic disease and that there was a chance that you were going to be an alcoholic?
Yeah. I'm not sure if I ever learned that. All I know is the first time I picked up booze, I fell in love with it, and that was it. Yeah. I mean, I didn't socially drink that much. It was once I drank, that was it. I mean, it was a love affair. It was a total love affair. And I really believe if the drugs didn't come into the picture, I could have drank for 20 more years. I mean, I don't know that for a fact, but because I started doing cocaine and because I started getting into legal problems and getting arrested and trying to pull check scams and getting into trouble and all that, I think the cocaine brought me to my knees. But yeah, the booze was a total love affair. I mean, yeah. What's really funny is when my mother drove me to treatment, and I remember this intake, and the guy said, "So you have a problem with drugs?" And I said, "Yep, definitely. I have a problem with cocaine. And, you know, I smoke a ton of pot and blah, blah, blah." And then he said, "And do you think you're an alcoholic?" And I said, "Absolutely." And my mother goes, "No, you're not."
Well, yeah, because she's not.
Right. And it was so hilarious. It's like, Mom, I've been drinking like a case of beer a day, you know, especially when you're coked up. Yeah. And I said, of course I'm an alcoholic. But it was like so interesting because for her, it was okay that I had a cocaine problem. But for her to acknowledge that I had an alcohol problem would mean she'd have to look at herself. And she just wasn't able to do that at that time. So
absolutely. Because she didn't have a coke problem. She did have a drinking problem. So tell me a little bit about the progression of your disease.
Yeah. I mean, at a party, you know, like I talk about in the book, my first addiction was food. I had a weight issue when I was really young and, you know, I totally addicted to sugar. And then I picked up booze in like ninth or 10th grade. And I remember the thought that this is the solution to all my problems. Mm-hmm. I mean, it just was. I remember going to this party and I was overweight and I was not in the cool crowd and I didn't have a boyfriend. And I remember making people laugh and thinking, oh my God, people actually like me and I can fit in and all the stuff you typically hear at an AA meeting. So yeah, that definitely was the solution.
Yeah. You picked up a drink. You were 50 pounds lighter. You were lighter. A cool girl and you were dating Brad Pitt.
That's right. Exactly. So yeah, the progression, like I said, was quick and I bottomed out. I mean, I only drank and drugged for like 8 or 9 years and I got sober at 24, 25. So I crashed and burned. I had been up for like 3 days. I was staying at this coke dealer's house and it was the middle of the night and I woke up on the floor and I felt like bugs were crawling all over me and I was hallucinating and I just, you know, kind of crawled out of this apartment and went to a phone booth back then and called my brother who kind of came and rescued me. And then I got into the hospital within a couple of days. So yeah, that was it.
And then, so you're a one trick pony.
I'm a one trick pony. And, you know, it's interesting because even though it's been a long time, I still can bring up very easily the sensation of incomprehensible demoralization. I mean, a lot of my acting out was sexually. And, you know, as my sponsor said once, her sex list was longer than her resentment list. So that was a source of my shame, my worst bottoms, really, that was a lot of the work I had to do in those early years. I don't know if you ever read the book, Women, Sex, and Addiction by Charlotte Castle. It's all about sexual addiction and sexual codependency. And that was like my Bible for the first 5 to 10 years of sobriety. And another book by her, Many Roads, One Journey, kind of the feminist aspects of recovery. So that, and really when you look at it, it's really the untreated codependency, the untreated trauma, all of that, the untreated ACOA stuff, all manifesting in acting out behavior, right? Which was my go-to for quite a while.
So let's hear about having sex in treatment. Who was this fine specimen?
This fine gentleman, Billy. Yeah. God, you know, I mean, you're in treatment. You're out of your mind. I mean, I was out of my mind.
You're out of your mind for like the first 10 years.
You're absolutely right. I was out of my mind. I can still be out of my mind. Mm-hmm. And, you know, my apartment, I had an apartment at the time that was only like 5 miles away. So Billy and I hooked up and, yeah, we'd go on our Saturday 3 hour passes to my apartment, but it started in the laundry room. I do remember that. So yeah. Yeah.
Did you stay in contact with Billy when you left?
No, I didn't stay in contact with him. You know what? It's really shocking. And I'm sure others have had this experience. Not many people were still sober a year later.
Yeah. I think I was the only one.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So did you, as soon as you left treatment, did you dive into the program, like head in?
I really did. I mean, I really did. I dove in and just went to meetings all the time. All my pals were in meetings. I went back to college eventually, but I was still really active. And I also, after a couple of years, you know, like you are a seeker. I mean, I wanted to do everything. I was doing this course. I was doing this, you know, ropes course. I was doing this New Age weekend seminar. I just was so looking for the answers. And so I was majoring in psychology and sociology. So I was seeking all the time. And meetings, you know, meetings were more of a social thing back then, I think, or in those early years. It was more like, you know, let me go to the Friday night NA meeting so I can hook up for the weekend. I mean, I could tell you stories. Oh my God. I remember being in an NA meeting. This is like when I'm 9 months sober. And
there was four people in there that you had slept with. Is that what you're going to say?
Not this meeting, but it was woman's meeting.
Okay.
It was a woman's meeting. And all of a sudden in the middle of this meeting, this woman says, I just want you to know that someone in here slept with my boyfriend. And I'm like, what? I mean, I think what bitch would have done that, right? And then the more she's talking, the more I realize it was me. And this guy, Mike, had literally come up to me after I got my 90-day chip and said, I've been waiting for you.
Oh, what a stud.
It's so awful to think about this stuff, but it is addicts in early recovery in their 20s. I mean, that's what we were doing, right? So, yeah. And so anyways, this woman, we went outside. I talked it out. I said, listen, I didn't know he had a girlfriend. I mean, my God, maybe you should be talking to him, not me, is the point.
Shit.
Anyways. So, yeah.
Was there any resolution there?
I don't know what happened to their relationship, but yeah. Yeah. I mean, NA back in the day. Yeah.
So when obviously you didn't follow the 1 year rule, neither did I.
No.
Were you being honest with your sponsor about any of that stuff, or were you keeping it to yourself?
Good question. I mean, I was someone that probably called my sponsor every 6 months. I wasn't someone who had a sponsor that I was like actively calling every day.
Okay.
So I was pretty much self-will run riot. Yeah.
And yeah. Were you making girlfriends?
Yeah, I had, it's interesting because I had a couple of girlfriends, but my best friend literally until the time I went to graduate school was a guy, the same with Kevin. And he was my best friend for those first, say, 7 years. And then I moved to California. And I definitely had girlfriends, but was definitely way more comfortable around guys, as you hear a lot of women say early on in recovery. Now I have all women friends, mainly. But yeah, those early years, I think, because I grew up with boys, and I always felt like a tomboy, and probably because of my mother being an alcoholic, I don't know what your experience was, didn't trust women a lot, and it was harder to get to know women early on, absolutely.
So then tell me about the progression of your broken picker in sobriety that led you to your bottom.
Yeah. So just lots of crazy relationship experiences. You know, I talk about in the book that about that experience when I went to the Club Med and came home and I was on a date and then the guy from the Club Med is on my porch. I mean, I just, I couldn't say no, first of all. Very hard to say no. I was still being driven by the fear of not being wanted. I mean, that when I've done my fourth steps in, you know, since then, that was really my baseline fear, the fear of not being loved, the fear of not being wanted, that basically got me into every relationship. Because it wasn't about whether they were appropriate or not. It was, first of all, it was just attraction based. And then usually you realize 3 months later, oh my God, they're not the right person for me. What am I doing here? So a lot of that initial attraction, sex too soon, they're not the right person, breakup, a lot of that. Mm-hmm. And then when I went to graduate school and got into consistent therapy and went to that treatment center for the codependency, I ended up having longer relationships. I dated a guy for a couple of years when I was in graduate school. And it was just got to the point where he decided I wasn't the one. And that relationship ended. And then I met Sean when I was with my first husband in San Diego. But the relationships got longer and still was hard, I think, up until, God, you know, the last 10 years, maybe 20 years. I was going to say, I would have to think about, I do believe that I know your listeners are probably going to cringe at this. If you can wait to have sex, you can really end a lot of relationships sooner and not get yourself all emotionally twisted up. And it makes life so much easier. Because once you start having sex, it's that pseudo intimacy, like in that you actually feel like you're close, but you're really not. And then you wake up 6 months later and you don't even like the person. So anyways, the relationships definitely got better. And I think, like I say in the book, you know, Sean, I was my late 30s when I met him. So I was really thinking at that time, oh my gosh, am I ever going to get married? Am I ever going to have a child? And I really wanted to fit him into my, fit a square into a round hole. Not that we didn't have, you know, he on one hand, and this is the tricky thing, like nothing is black or white, right? It's always both end. On one hand, Sean is an awesome human being. I mean, he was a really spiritual guy. He was sober. He was a writer. He was really into personal growth. He had sold his advertising company and had been traveling around the state of California, and very interesting, a tad narcissistic, you know, very seductive. I could listen to him forever and gratify his ego, I'm sure. So I think that kind of, there was a lot of drama in that relationship. Like we'd break up and get back together. And then I really think fear is probably, I mean, we did one of those Catholic, even though I'm not Catholic, but one of those church weekend things where, you know, you address all these aspects of the possible marriage, the pre-marriage thing. And literally at the end, the priest said, you really should, you shouldn't get married. I mean,
wow.
So good. Just weren't, didn't have enough in common. And of course we got married anyways and had a great wedding, but I always say I had the quickest marriage in history, but I did have Beau, who's my son. And so it all worked out and God's got a plan and all that. And he's still in my life. But that was definitely a crash and burn, a big crash and burn. Yeah, with the codependency.
And so, yeah it sucks.
I know.
Yeah, I just think you feel so much more, I felt so much more raw than I did when in early sobriety, you know? I also think too, like, the amount of shame that's there too. You know, it was just so much easier for me to be like, okay, yeah, no, I was an alcoholic. I like these chemicals. Of course I was behaving in that way. I was not in my right mind. Right. But the shame of being sober, being in a 12-step program for years, working the 12 steps, doing, and to still be behaving in that way.
Yes.
It's so shameful, but that's why having the realization that there was trauma.
Yeah.
Was such a weight off my shoulders.
Yes.
Yeah. So, do you want to talk a little
bit? Doing...
Go ahead.
Yeah. I was just going to say, I always think we're doing exactly what we were trained to do. Do you know what I mean? It's like, I never think there's any mistake or like, it's this intentional thing. We have these childhoods, we develop these belief systems, we develop these coping skills, and it, and everything that happens is exactly the way that, that mind is going to operate. Do you know what I mean? It's not a mystery. So like you say, until you start, I mean, I remember when I read that Red book for the first time, I was like, holy
fucking shit. I know. It's me. It's
Like, absolutely. And I had read, you know, Codependent No More and all the books from the 80s, Claudia Black and Janet Woitz and Melody Beattie and all these people, you know, Jonathan Bradshaw, all these people that were doing that, you know, the inner child and the codependency and all that stuff. But that Red book, I just remember like, wow, they are just nailing it. Yeah.
Well, that's
just
what
it is. Identifying the symptoms and the
It's powerlessness. It's like, it's another level of powerlessness. Like I couldn't expect, like, I kept being like, okay, I'm going to do things differently next time. I didn't have a fucking choice to do things differently next time because I had was suffering from complex trauma. And just like when I ingest a drink, all bets are off. Same thing goes when I enter a relationship and I haven't resolved any of my trauma. So that's why it was like, huge one, just like the relief of like, oh, I'm not inherently flawed. And two, oh, there's a solution for this as well.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. And that's what really I like to focus on too, because I do believe everybody, I mean, you know, obviously there's a continuum, but everybody's got some type of trauma, especially if you're a woman in recovery. I mean, let's face it. That we can identify the problems, but what are the solutions? What is going to be helpful? How do we change these behaviors? I mean, whatever they are, you know, when we look at those self-seeking behaviors, they're all just adaptations, you know, how we survived, how we felt safe, you know, whether it was avoidant behavior or acting out behavior or people pleasing or rationalization, or it doesn't matter what it is. It's realizing, like you're saying, gee, these things aren't working anymore. What's going to be helpful? So yeah, absolutely. Identification absolutely is the first step. Like you said, I remember when I first read that book back in the 80s, The Courage to Heal, which is about sexual abuse. I remember I had the same experience, like, oh my God, somebody knows what it's like. And it's the same feeling with that Red book. Like, wow, somebody really gets this.
Yes. So, it was like all the things that had been running in my head, thinking that I was the only one, and then seeing it on paper. Like, it was life-changing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yes, yes, yes. Yeah.
So you're saying, like, how do we change? I mean, it's not one size fits all, right? So what did What did it look like for you?
When I was pregnant with my son, I went to my first Al-Anon meeting. And so that's 21 years ago. And definitely, you know, the 12 steps, the CODA, the Al-Anon, the ACOA, all of those 12-step programs and all the workbooks and therapy, all of those have contributed to my recovery. And I always say this, even when people in AA, it's like there's this transition from the kind of pointing the finger and blaming and, you know, first it's your parents, then it's your whatever, your partner, to, wow, I am responsible. I mean, you know, you can go to a meeting and someone has 25 years of sobriety and they're still bitching about their wife or whatever. It's like, until someone really owns and acknowledges, wow, I am the problem, I've got the stuff, I don't know how they can move forward and find peace and happiness, because you're just going to be stuck in that resentment, you know, the irritable, restless, and discontent, you know, which isn't just alcoholics. I mean, that's the human condition. I mean, it's always going to be better or different somewhere else, being somewhere else, when something else happens, when this happens, you know, it's that delusion, right?
Yeah. 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 And just because it's us, I mean, we might not be, you know, we're obviously not responsible for what happened to us as kids, but guess what? We're the only ones that can do anything about addressing that shit. Like, we can, I wish our parents could go to therapy for us, but it just doesn't fucking work that way.
Right. Yeah, exactly. It's still about, we're not responsible for what happened, but the thing is, like we've been talking about, all of those things have been internalized, and now we're operating with all these coping behaviors, all of these strange ways we think that are going to work, but they really don't work. And we keep hitting the wall over and over again. And it's like, oh, what, you know, what can I do differently? And I always
common denominator in this. It's fucking me.
Yes. And so often, and I know this is a simplification, but I often say this to people in like the codependency groups, it's, you know, like we said at the beginning, I have to tolerate what's happening inside of me. You know, I have to identify, experience, and express my feelings. I have to tolerate the terror, the fear, the abandonment experience, whatever is happening, without necessarily doing anything. Right. And, you know, and when I say in the book, you know, I am still a psychologist, obviously, but in my practice, you know, I say this, if people could do two things, I wouldn't have a job. If they could speak up for themselves and set boundaries, like literally those are the two things that were just so common with everybody. And I think, and those two things have to do with being able to tolerate our feelings. I can't speak up and set a boundary unless I can tolerate what's happening inside of me. And I can tolerate what's happening inside of me when you get upset or disappointed or whatever, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Just putting something down that I want to ask you about in a little bit.
Sure.
So other outside of 12 steps, What type of work did you do for yourself personally, related to addressing the trauma that was of like particularly effective for you?
Yes. I eventually got into, I don't know if you've read any of the Peter Levine stuff or Bessel van der Kolk or the body stuff.
Yep.
So I did obviously talk therapy for a long time and programs and workshops and all of that stuff. But I really felt like several years ago, I did a somatic experiencing, it's called training, which is the type of therapy that Peter Levine does and the body therapies. And I really felt as though that was kind of the next level of getting into my body.
When was it? When did you do this?
This was maybe... Yeah, this is the most recent. So this is between 5 and 10 years ago.
Okay.
Yeah. Obviously, I'd read his books and done that. But as far as really experiencing it and getting into this type of therapy was more recent. And since 2011, which is when my second divorce, which I got to keep saying those words. It always like provokes a mini shame attack. Okay.
It could be fourth.
And right? No, I guess I should feel.
Yeah, I'm sure there's some people listening. They're like, only second. Well, fuck you, lady.
You never know what lessons you're supposed to learn, right?
Exactly.
But yeah, the trauma stuff. So I really thought the body stuff brought it to a new level of, you know, they talk about it being top down, meaning there's just something missing when you're just doing the talk therapy. There's something else when you become a meditator or yoga or whatever it is that works for you, where you can tolerate being present in your own body. And that for me was a big part of it. And they do this certain method where I found you can get in touch with stuff very quickly. I mean, we would get to an incident from God knows when, like within a couple of sessions, and have this, and it's all about kind of reprogramming your nervous system. The theory is that you didn't complete these cycles of your activation. Yep. And it's all about kind of completing those cycles so your system can be calmer. And so again, it's not really any one thing, but definitely that was, I thought, really helpful for trauma. It is trauma therapy.
Were you working with somebody one-on-one for this, or was it a group thing?
Okay. Yes. Yeah.
Yep. And is it people that have been trained underneath Peter Levine, or what is it?
Yes, it's, there's a website, and my brother, who's a therapist also, he and I went and did the first training, and it's just fascinating. And
what's it called?
It's called somatic experiencing is the type of therapy, S-E. Yeah. And I'm sure there's tons of other body therapies, but, and they're few and far between. There's a big website though, that'll show practitioners, and you can look up and find one if you want.
I want him on the podcast.
Oh, well, he's, I have some of his CDs, and he's gotten, obviously, I mean, he's probably like 80 now. I'm not sure old he is now.
Okay.
He's definitely up there. But Bessel van der Kolk is another person who's written recently on trauma in the body. And
amazing too.
Yeah. I mean, it's really the wave of the last, I would say, 20 years, finally focusing, you know, saying that it's not just a mental thing, that it's also our bodies, right?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Especially that. Yeah. The complex trauma piece.
Right. Right.
So, okay. So let's get into some questions. I'm going to pull up for my Patreon, but the one thing I wanted to ask you, so we were in my group last night, in my Patreon group, we were talking about this, and what a few of the girls, you just made the comment about, like, if we could speak up for ourselves and if we could set boundaries, then you wouldn't have a job. So what a few people brought up is they're like, I don't even know how to discern what my needs are.
Yeah. Yeah. You know what? One of my mantras that I do with my groups and my clients for years are, one of your mantras should be, what do I need? What do I want? What do I need? What do I want? Because you're absolutely right. It's very hard to express a need if you don't know what it is. So the first step, you're absolutely right, is what is the need? What is my need right now? Do I need validation? Do I need someone to listen? Do I need to feel loved? Do I need to be heard? Do I need to be understood? Do I need to feel safe? What is the need I'm having right now? You're absolutely right. And then you have to be in a safe enough relationship, obviously, to be able to express it. The problem is we're so crippled by our fears from the past that, again, it goes to how can I sit with the discomfort and still speak? You know, I'll give you a great example of someone on a group the other night. So she, in recovery, like 15 years, just starting to do this CODA work, has a dad, her mom passed away, but she's very codependent with her dad. And her dad has been calling her like 4 or 5 times a day for years and says, I just wanted to see how you were, which really means I need you to make me feel okay. But
absolutely.
And so she said in the group, so she said, I finally realized and had to sit with the discomfort of my father being upset, my father maybe pulling away from me, because then that's a whole other thing. You know, what's going to happen if I set the boundary? And she ended up having a conversation with him about, you don't really need to call me this much. I love you. And if something's wrong, I'll definitely let you know. But it really opened up. But the terror she was feeling around that conversation was probably of a five-year-old girl, you know, and her father would go out and get drunk that night. It probably had nothing to do with what she's trying to do today. But that's the thing. You know, it's always about a past fear, a past experience, a past time we were hurt. You know, under each resentment is a hurt. And so if you can connect that also, that's really helpful because it helps us to calm down in the present moment. Sorry, I know I'm off on a tangent, but
you're not.
Yeah. So noticing, you know, noticing your experience, noticing your feelings, identifying a fear and identifying what you need. Then there's the speaking up, right? Then there's the expressing it. Now, what's the fear there? And am I afraid they're going to get mad at me? Am I afraid they're going to be disappointed? Am I afraid they're going to abandon me? That's a big one, right? And again, all those are usually from the past. So again, it's tolerating. Okay, what do I need to tolerate while I express this need? And then once you have more experiences where the person hasn't abandoned you, where they've actually listened to you, where you have these positive experiences, then you're building up your bank of, oh, I can't express a need and they won't get upset, you know?
Yeah. And I would think so too, like with the not knowing what our needs are, I think part of that too is like, we have to do that inner work too, right? And so that's part of it too, is like, as we heal our unresolved shit, it's going to be a lot easier for us to identify like what our actual needs are.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely.
So it's like getting sober in a way.
Yes. Yes. Yeah. And when you're so focused on others and feeling safe, if the people around you are okay, I'm okay. Mm-hmm. You know, you may know what your partner's needs are way before you know what yours are. Because that's absolutely the dynamic, right?
Yeah. They don't have to tell you. You fucking know. You wake up with a to-do list. They don't even have to tell you. Okay.
Wish they could read your mind though, because it's so hard to express. I've had plenty of women be upset. Like, why doesn't he just know? It's like,
because we can read their mind so easily. That's
right. There you go.
Okay. So this, Alexandria wants to know, she's curious about, how codependency can appear in the workplace and how to exit those relationships in a respectful manner. She says, especially if a person you're dependent on is toxic and has little respect for any personal boundaries. So what are your thoughts on codependency in the workplace?
Yeah, I think it happens all the time. I mean, I have an example of a gal I'm sponsoring right now who is having a lot of codependence. She's the boss. And one of the people that works under her is constantly disruptive in meetings. And because of her own fears, with her own history, with her own mom, she has such a hard time setting the limit because of this fear they're going to get upset or she's going to look bad or whatever it is. And finally, just last week, with a lot of support and looking at what was the cause, you know, the other thing about codependency is that it's not helping the other person.
Yeah, no kidding.
That's it's hurting them. Solution. I know, but we believe we're doing them a favor by not speaking up. When on the other hand, everybody else is suffering. Everybody else is pissed off that the guy's interrupting. And so when you address it, you're not only helping yourself, you're helping the other person. I mean, so again, I say this so much, but identifying the problem, noticing your feelings about the problem, I would also say, if you're having a certain anxiety or a certain activation of anger, what is it that's getting activated? Mm-hmm. You know, because people in the workplace are just going to activate our parent stuff, right? Mm-hmm. Whether it's your boss or whether it's your partner. If you're getting angry at someone, what's it activating? You don't feel good enough. You don't feel heard. You don't feel understood. So it's identifying that activation first, so you can calm down before you communicate. That's another thing. So you're not just acting out and exploding at work.
Yeah. I think what you said there about the it not being helpful, I think what's interesting too about codependency is like at its core, it is essentially selfish, you know?
Well, because it's about our own fear.
Yeah.
We don't have to think it's about other people, but you know, it's like someone said recently, you know, the term people pleasing is a delusion. He said, people aren't pleased. You're not pleasing anyone. Yeah. And that was a great line. It's like, yeah, we believe we're these people pleasers, but most of the time,
the nature. Yeah.
Yes. Right. Right.
Okay. Let's see what we have next. Okay. This is from Chelsea. She said, I think in your last episode, you touched a bit on this, but I always thought I was empathetic and I could be slightly. However, I know for a fact that I am codependent. Does this happen a lot? Do people tend to think they're empathetic or being empathetic when in reality, they're just a codependent? Having both would be hard. And from what I've read, codependency and the difference between codependent and empathetic is codependent, there is a lack of the authentic self. Thoughts on this?
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think that's a great distinction. Again, codependency is coming from fear. I don't think empathy is. Empathy is coming from a sincere empathy for someone else's issues or someone else's difficulty they're having in that day. The codependency
being able to relate.
Yes. It's always getting active. The codependency is activated usually by a fear, you know, not feeling in control, fear of, you know, how you're going to look. And so it's more of this fear-driven need rather than true connection. Mm-hmm. I mean, absolutely, it's hard to be authentic when you're being driven by what someone else thinks of you or how you're looking to someone else or trying not to upset someone. I mean, again, like you just said, if you don't even know what you need or want, how can you communicate authentically? Mm-hmm. Right? Yeah.
Okay. Well, this kind of like goes to what we were just talking about. So Sophie said, I struggle distinguishing between codependency and people pleasing. I'd love to know the difference. I mean, I think that it's one and the same. I mean, yeah.
I mean, people pleasing, I would say, is one behavior trait of codependency.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah.
So this is from Emily. She says, I have trouble distinguishing between codependency and my trauma responses and trigger. I go back between thinking I'm in a healthy relationship and thinking I'm codependent due to lack of self-esteem and difficulty identifying my feelings. I suppose it does go all hand in hand. I'm probably just codependent. I mean, I think, and what Tion Dayton speaks about is that what she believes is that, like, at the root of codependency, it's trauma. It's not a set of behaviors. It is a result of unresolved trauma.
Yeah. I mean, I think out of the unresolved trauma come the behaviors, right? Yeah. Yeah. And it depends the degree. It depends what the trauma is. It depends a lot of times what your interpretation of the trauma. Two people can have the same experience, different interpretation.
Exactly.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. My adult child rock bottom was realizing that my, if you're not okay, I'm not okay, existence was running the show, yeah. My life. I would get so deep into others' needs and give until resentment, because yeah. I ultimately felt like used like a doormat, erupted in my me drowning in anger. So in my efforts thus far have been figuring out how to love myself, which has eluded me all my life. Then maybe I will know what boundaries I need. Is that when it happens? I guess we kind of spoke on that, right? It's about figuring out, resolving our shit, working on ourselves in order to unearth what we really do, what need.
Right. I mean, that's kind of the cycle. She exactly just said the cycle, right? I'm going to be this person for you because I can't really be with myself. And the delusion is I'm going to be happy, but really all it leads to is more fear and resentment. The trouble is, if you don't deal with the resentments and the anger, I mean, I swear, I sometimes think I could have written a book just on anger. I think anger is such a significant piece in the sense of, I don't think a lot of people know they're angry.
Exactly.
But I think it comes out in a variety of ways. And I do think if you don't resolve your resentments from the past, you are going to keep... they're going to keep manifesting in your future relationships. So that was just another thing I'd say, if she's angry, you know, that's still there. And that would be something definitely, especially with women, you know, we can deny it, try to be nice, but wow. I mean, We carry a lot of anger and aren't aware of it, I think, because of our how we behave sometimes. Or we're just a bitch or whatever. Yeah. You know?
We talked about that last night in my group as well. So like throughout your career, like helping codependents, what are like some of the, I don't know, what are some of the the biggest roadblocks that you've seen or like the biggest resistances that tend to get in the way?
I think people don't want their relationships to change, even if it's really horrible. You know, I think it's hard to, people resist change. So they may want a relationship to be different, but they want the other person to change very often, like we've been saying. I think you have to hit a bottom where you're willing to give up, you know, where you say to yourself, no matter what happens in this relationship, I'm willing to let it go if I don't get my needs met. Because a lot of times people are just afraid, like we're saying, afraid to be themselves, afraid to speak their truths, afraid to express what they need. You know, a lot of times I say, people are afraid to express what they need because what if the person says, I can't meet those needs? You know, it's much easier to live in a delusion that, oh, I just can't express it, instead of actually asking for it. And the person's like, no, I don't want to have a child, or I don't want to get married, or whatever the issue is. You know, it's a way we can control the narrative and control what's going to happen. So it takes a lot of responsibility to kind of acknowledge, like, wow, like you're saying, I've got to focus on myself. I've got to figure out what I want. And then I need to express it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's like that moment where the fear and pain of staying the same finally is greater than the fear or pain of change.
Yes. Yes.
And that yes. takes a lot of fucking pain.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, because we can rationalize. I mean, you know this. I mean, we've all been in relationships where we can rationalize anything. Anything. You know, and I think the you know, more troubled we are and the more detached we are from ourselves, the bigger things we can rationalize. The more fear we have about being alone or feeling our feelings, the more we can rationalize.
Do you ever come across many low bottom codependents?
Do I come across them?
Yeah. Like, I mean, I feel like, I don't know, like, are there any ever people that are coming like in, they're like, hey, you know, like I stubbed my toe and I think I might have this. So what do I need to do? And then they right. do it. Does that ever happen?
I think people can die from codependency.
Oh, shit.
I think, yeah, people can, I think a lot of physical illness. I don't know if you've read any Gabor Mate, but, you know, his whole book, When the Body Says No, I mean, the whole book is about codependency and illness and its connection to it. I mean, when we don't speak up and when we have years of rage built up, I mean, we can get physically sick and it can manifest in all kinds of ways. Depression, you know, just that alone, panic attacks, physical problems, headaches, stomach aches. I mean, chronic unhappiness, workaholism, any addiction. I mean, it's all so connected.
All the things.
Absolutely. Yes.
So this book is amazing. What I think is really, and everyone needs to go check it out, Co-Crazy, I'll leave it in the show notes. But what I think is good, and I think it's kind of similar to like my podcast, is like, I think that you're really good of like breaking down information in a very palatable way for people. So you want to talk about what was your intention behind, what can people take away from this?
I try to keep it simple. I just really felt so strongly. I mean, I had this experience probably 5 years ago where I went to an Al-Anon meeting one night and it was in the middle of the opiate epidemic. And there was one woman there. And I remember thinking to myself, what the F? How is this possible? Like, I know there's tons of addicts and alcoholics in where I live, in all the neighboring towns. And how is it that there's one person at this meeting when people are dying from the opiate? You know what I mean? And so I just felt so strongly that I had to get a message out there about people who know addicts, and also that codependency is not just living with an addict or alcoholic. I mean, I really see it on a continuum. I see tons of parents. This is a whole other book, but parents that are super codependent with their kids and controlling with their kids and can't tolerate, you know, their own experiences. I mean, I know moms that literally have to keep their kids so busy all the time because they can't be alone with them for a couple hours. Mm. I mean, it's a freaking epidemic. I mean, I could talk about that for hours. I mean, this whole staying busy because you can't tolerate being around kids. I mean, it's so parenting at your jobs. I mean, friendships. I mean, how many times have I heard people say, oh, I can't say that to my friend. They'll get mad at me. That's codependency. I mean, it's so subtle and it permeates everything. And that's why I feel so strongly about it. So I appreciate you having me.
I will send you that little last part that was fucking powerful. And we need to promote that shit. Just that last what you just said was very, very good. Where can people find you? How do you want to be found?
Just right now, I just have a website up. I literally am just in the process of transitioning and getting onto social media. I've had a practice for 30 years that I'm finally kind of winding down. And so I'm going to be more into kind of getting out there with this information, whatever that looks like, whatever the universe thinks I should be doing, I'm up for it. So yeah, drsarahmisho.com right now. And it has an email if you want to contact me or send me a note or you have comments about the book, definitely let me know. And yeah.
This is your first podcast and you're a fucking pro, so.
Oh, you're so great. Thank you so much. Anything I can do to be helpful.
What you holding on to? Just let it all go. What's making you slow now? Just let it all go. What you got to do, yeah?
What is dedication?
The thing that drives me every day as a dad is Dariana. We call him Day Day for short. Every day he's hungry for something, whether it's attention, affection, knowledge. And there's this huge responsibility in making sure that when he's no longer under my wing, that he's a good person. I want him to be able to sit back one day and go, we worked together, we did a good job.
That's dedication. Find out more at fatherhood.gov. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Ad Council.